How to Become. With thanks to Port Arlington Further Education and Training Centre. Learn about our full and part-time further education and training courses and our third level and higher education undergraduate and postgraduate courses. PortArlingtonFETC.ie.
Welcome to everybody. We're here again with the Lewis Cannons, myself, Helen Steins, and
myself, Mary Sherwin.
And we're here with another episode of How to Become. Our episode today is How to Become a Private Investigator, and we have Pat Murray in with us. Hello, yeah. Pat.
Hello, ladies. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Oh, sure, sitting up and eating a wee bit. Not so bad.
I understand that you were a detective sergeant. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, I was a detective inspector Loud Division the last 10 years of my career. And when I retired, I left early. I could have stayed on for another 6 years, but I was very, not enthralled by Garda management and the way the job was going, and just I knew it was time to get out.
Okay.
And I stayed on till I solved Adrian Donoghue's murder, and I said when I'd solved that, I'm going. So the day I charged Darren Brady with the murder is the day I handed in my retirement papers.
Wow.
And I had my mind made up. I was going to move to Mullingar because my wife's from Mullingar, and that I was going to set up a private investigation business. So that was it. So I set up below, like, and the process of actually becoming a private investigator is that you apply to the PSA to say you want to become a private investigator, and they will tell you, will tell me what qualifications have you got, or why do you want to become a private investigator? What can you bring to the table as a private investigator? So I was able to tell them that I solved this murder and that murder and all the bits and pieces, and I'm a qualified senior investigating officer. It's a degree course in Limerick University. It's recognised. And I was a fully trained scenes of crime examiner. I had lots of photography courses done, firearms courses done, all that type of stuff. So they sent back an email to me and says, yes, we believe that you would fit the criteria for being a private investigator. So you had to fill out an application form and send it in then, like, you know, which I did.
Right. What is the PSA?
Private Security Authority, which is a statutory body that looks at, bouncers and doors and the security systems around, and all of that type of stuff, that everyone is regulated. And the private investigations is one, the private investigator is one of the areas they look at, you know.
Right.
So you have to get a licence. So I applied for my licence and I was given my licence. It was, 1,500 euro is what it costs for a 2-year period. And within that period of time, you're audited by the PSA, and they had various companies that would come and could come on spec and say, what are you doing now, and that you were, let's say, keeping within the guidelines in respect to GDPR and all of that type of stuff, and that you had all your paperwork in order. And so that was it. So it's the PSA are fairly, they're active, and they are strict. And if you were conducting your business outside of what they expect, they'll just take the licence off you. Rightly so. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem being regulated, and I have no problem being vetted, or not vetted, but being audited. I have no issues, Private investigations, like, let's say, serious murders and stuff, like, it's a lot of it is common sense and how you approach things and what decisions you make to move things forward,
Imagine it's not like Magnum PI or the Rockford Files.
No. I'm a big Columbo fan myself, but no, it's nothing like that at all. Oh my God. Murder investigations are just pure, honest to God, hard slog. And when I mean hard slog, I mean hard slog. Day in, day out, going through the nitty gritty, everything to make sure you don't miss anything. And, I had a formula that I stuck with. Developed it myself and stuck with it, and it worked. And if investigators stick with what I used to stick with, they won't go too far wrong, But there again, I left the Guards.
You entered fairly young, didn't you? Was this something you had wanted to do?
No, I was 25 when I joined.
It's young enough.
Yeah, but like there was guys down there straight out of school, okay. 19, and wouldn't advise it. I worked for 7 years in the private sector. I worked in Navan Carpets for a couple of years. I went to a company in Ashbourne called Union Camp. They were an American packaging company, and I was there for 3 years. And they were very good to me. And when I was leaving to be a guard, they kept my job open for me.
Fair. Especially because when you start training in the Guards, it is hard.
Oh, it is
money and away from home and the training
and all that
is
type
tough,
of stuff. Like, and you had to sort of think to yourself, is this really what I want? Like, this is what I wanted in my mind and whatever. And is it really all what it should be? Like, you know?
Yeah.
And the training that we went through in Templemore, the 6 months, was very intense. But when you come out into the real world, like what you learned was totally different than what you actually... what's out there, like,
yeah,
you know.
And depending on where you're stationed or who you're working with.
Yeah, and that's it, you know. I was stationed in Donnybrook for the first year and a half, full of posts and beats and that type of stuff, like, but nothing over exciting, like, you know. And I wrote about in my first book, like, I used to get bored silly, like, you'd be standing outside an embassy at all hours of the morning, like, you know. I remember lying down in the middle of the road looking up at the moon and saying, what's all this about, like, you know.
Yeah. What am I doing?
Yeah, what am I doing? Like, you know, and I was in two minds whether I'd go back to Union Camp or not. But I looked for a transfer and got it to Blanchardstown. And that was a totally different policing area and different set of, a different set of problems. Like,
you have been involved in really serious murder crimes.
Yes,
how do you deal with that kind of thing? Like, how do you decompress afterwards?
Well, I don't know. I suppose they came rolling onto my desk. I didn't...
You didn't go looking for them, obviously.
No. They always followed me around for some reason. But the first murder as a detective inspector was the murder of Niall Dorr in October 2010. He was the chap that was beaten to death in the street in Dundalk. And I hadn't even been in Dundalk Station. Didn't even know where it was because I spent most of my time in Drogheda. And I was told, this chap died last night, you know, you want to go up and see about it and get it investigated, you know. So I went up and found Dundalk Garda Station and went in. I didn't know anybody. But we sort of got through the Niall Dorr investigation and covered what we needed to cover, but we weren't having any luck with witnesses but that could actually identify and pick out the guy who done all the kicking and killing him, like, you know. But we got to the end of that one by... we had one witness who stuck his head out the window, was shouting at this fella, leave him alone, leave him alone. And he said he was jumping on his head and kicking him out, he said, and then he pulled him off the road. He said, when he was pulling him off the road, he said, the young fella's T-shirt came off, he said. And then when he got him onto the footpath, he said, he jumped on his head again and he banged his head off the wheel of the car. And he said he was picking his head up, he said, about 5 feet and then just smashing it off the ground. He said he was just, he says, and I was shouting out, and he said, and then eventually he stopped and went off. But he says, I can tell you one thing about him, he said, there was a gang of them, he said, but he's the only one wearing a shirt. The rest of T-shirts, and he was very observant. So when we went back over CCTV of the town and picked them out earlier,
we found the guy with the shirt.
We could pick out the guy with the shirt. But when we arrested him, he denied all knowledge and denied, wasn't there, don't know anything about it, you have it all wrong, this, that and the other. Now, we did find a cigarette, a full made-up cigarette near the scene with his DNA in it, which it was a movable object. It held no value at that stage because he could have said, well, I give that to another fella yesterday to smoke or last week. It's, you know what I mean? It wasn't of any, had no weight. But what I did is that I brought the T-shirt up that was in the lab and I asked him to divide it from here up into squares of an inch back and front. And I wanted a DNA swab taken from each square.
Mm.
And they did that. And they rang me and they said, yes, we have two DNAs on that T-shirt. One is the deceased and the other is your suspect. And I said, he was grabbed around by the shoulders and they were able to say the squares they were in were synonymous with just grabbing and taking it off. So then I said, this is great. But then that wasn't the end of it because I said, this fella could say now, I was there, I was after spitting at him, like, you know, and me spit hit his T-shirt. Or I was sweating and he must have, some of me sweat must have dropped on him or whatever. So I went back to the forensic lab, and it's the first time this was done in Ireland, and they were able to do tests to show that it wasn't saliva, and that it wasn't sweat, that it had to be dermatological, it had to be skin,
wow,
skin particles. So we touched it. So wow. I had him. So, but apart from that, then I had to do a due diligence on the T-shirt, and the T-shirt was sold in a shop in Newry. So I done, when we had him in arrested, the second time we asked him, did he ever do any shopping in Newry? He says he never was in Newry in his life and all this type of stuff, you know. But young Nylor's mother had 2 days beforehand had washed it and ironed it and given it to him. So the likelihood of the culprit's DNA being on that T-shirt at any other time, it was a million to one chance. So look at... I got that's how I caught him, like, you know. Wow. And there was a little bit of DNA, and then with the due diligence of the T-shirt, like, you know, he couldn't have handled it anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And then when we put it, your DNA is on it, and he held his head down, he said, I don't know how it's there, I don't know, but he wouldn't admit, and he knew well, you know. Mm. And he wouldn't admit anything, so
yeah,
he was charged with murder.
And do you get frustrated? I mean, there's two questions come into my head as you were talking. I mean, obviously there are cases that have haunted you.
Well, the only one that has really haunted, there's always a case, is poor Ciara Breen, who was one of the girls that vanished in this triangle. Now I know who killed her, I know how she was killed, and I know where her body is. And we went and we looked for the body, and we arrested your man and all this, that and the other. And I got so, so close to solving that crime. We looked at it. It had been reviewed and everything, but we had a different look. And I looked at it from a different aspect. And we generated people who came forward and told us things that really showed that her body has to be in the bog, like, you know. Mm. And he had said it, that he had put her there, like, to people who had only come forward to us, you know, years later. But anyway, I had enough on him, but I needed a body. And if I had got a toenail, I had enough to charge him. Now, I remember we started digging the bog, and the forensic anthropologist said to me, Pat, there's problems here. And I says, she says, you're looking for a needle in a haystack, you're looking for half a needle now. And I says, why? Mm. She says, all the drains and all where you're looking, where you believe the body was, has been filled in with rubble. Builder's rubble. Someone had come down and dumped and dumped and dumped hundreds of tons of stuff. And she says, you won't get anything there. It's all dust now. She said, that's it.
Wow.
But I says, I'm not giving up. I'm keep going. I'm keep going. And that's it. And we spent a couple of weeks there digging and digging. But during the dig, clothes was thrown up. And I got all the clothes that was thrown up. I had them all washed, and there was no forensic value in them, like, you know, but they were all washed out. And one of the items of clothing missing out of poor Ciara's wardrobe was a floral dress. And we found a floral dress as described by her mother, like, in her statements. And I said, Jesus, this is... And it was found in around the area where we believed she could have been, you know. But anyway, we compiled a book of the photographs, like there was shoes, there was the jeans and all this, that and the other. And I asked her to go through the book, and she opened all the pictures and she came to the floral dress. And I was sitting there with another detective, and I was waiting for her to say, yeah, that's, because if she had said that's her dress, I had enough to charge him at work, you know. Mm. That's how close. And she looked and she went on. And then I said, look, have another look. When she finished the book, I said, just take it. And she went back again, and she came to the same picture, and she was looking and looking, and I could see it in her, like, you know, she didn't know what to say, and she kept going on. And then she says, no, there's nothing there. I said, that's grand. And that's how close I came to solving it, Ciara Breen's murder, like, you know. And that's the one that said, you win some, you lose some. You know, that's one I said, God, because I gave my word to Bernadette, like, you know, I'll do my best. I said, I'll get to the end of it. I'll just leave it with me, you know. And I didn't fulfil my promise, like, you know. And that's, you know, that was it. Like, and poor Bernadette is now dead, like, you know. And that's it. And that not haunted me, but it sort of annoyed me. So, well, that's one that got away from me. And no one really knows how close we got, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And, but we put in a huge effort.
How to Become, with thanks to Lear Business Services and Training Centre Mullingar, offering QQI certified online courses in key areas such as business administration, management, train the trainer, personal development and bespoke in-company training. LearBusinessCentre.com.
Has the job got easier over the years with forensics and stuff, with lab stuff?
DNA is definitely a big plus in the toolbox of the investigator, absolutely, phone analysis is a big thing, and obviously with the Joe O'Reilly, everyone. And if I've a new book coming out now in May, and it's all about Adrian Dunne's murder and how I used the fact that they didn't use phones on the night as evidence.
Wow, there you go. So they thought they were being clever.
Yeah. So I used that as evidence that they had all the phones turned off at a particular time between 8 and 10. And I went back over the last three Fridays and all of them were on. But why this one Friday, like, you know? And then I could connect them in other ways. And the fact that it was off, their phones were off, and the culprits were using walkie-talkies, because one of the girls that were robbed said, I could see one of them with a walkie-talkie, you know? So I used it all.
Communicating.
Yeah, I said, smart now this day, or I'm going to be smarter. And that's it. And you have to be, like, you have to, don't ever let them away with it, like, you know, and that's it.
I'm kind of intrigued about a person on a mind like you, with the fact that, like, are you ever kind of off your job? Is your mind, I know you say, is writing your way of switching off? Or
The Adrian Donoghue case, I think, is really one that needs to be told, and how we got it solved and how it developed. And the decisions made by myself as senior investigating officer on the night was so important of putting the investigation on the right track moving forward. Yeah, absolutely.
Because one thing goes wrong and that's it.
Oh, yeah. And then, you have to be sort of strong enough to be able to hold your team. And it's not no problem with the team. I had a great team, but it's management, Garda management, you know. What really annoyed me was I got the break in America and I developed a witness in America. And the witness was telling me, I know Aaron Brady, and he told me he shot the guard. And I said, would you make a statement? He says, no, I'm not making a statement. And I spoke with him for about 3 months, on and off, like, you know, do the right thing, this, that and the other. And I eventually got through to him. And he said it to me. He said, I think I'll make a statement. I said, well, that's great. I said, that's brilliant, you know. He says, well, he says, there's two people I respect in this world, he says, and I went to both of them. And the first fella told me, don't have anything got to do with guards, keep your mouth shut and just move on, don't say nothing. And he says, the other man told me, stand up, be a man, tell the truth, and that's it. And he says, I've thought about it, and I've thought about Adrian's wife and the children, he says, and I'm doing it for them. Now I said, you know, there's a reward. He says, don't mention reward to me. He says, I'm doing this for Adrian's children. And I says, well, I appreciate that. No, I said, that's gone. Well, he said, if you're over with me in 2 weeks on a certain date, I'll meet you. And I said, grand. And he gave me, I don't know, 24th and 5th Street or wherever it was in New York. Like, and he says, you be there on the corner and I'll meet you, you know. Now, as it turns out, Homeland Security had a facility very close, you know. And but I made my application to go to America. And I was hauled up by the higher-ups. How come we don't know about this witness? I says, because I didn't tell anyone. Why didn't you tell your chief superintendent?
And how different is being a private investigator to that work? You know, is it the same kind of work? Is it different work?
Yeah,
is it catching cheating wives? Or what kind of stuff are you doing?
I don't do any marital stuff at all.
Okay.
None. I said, keep well away from that crack, because there is no winners, like, you know. And it's heartache, and it's just not my thing. And I started taking on, like, I specialised in where employers would contact me and they'd say, look, we had an accident here, we had a guy, he fell and he hurt his back and he's out playing football every weekend, he's a big claim in and this and that and the other. So I got very skilled at that, at looking at it from the employer's point of view, and I made sure that they had all their records and all their induction training and all, you know,
Safety handling.
All of that stuff was done and everything. And then I would look at Pal and sometimes you get them, you'd do a bit of surveillance on them, you'd have them tumbling the hog in the garden or whatever. Like, so look, that type of stuff. But look, I got very good at that. And one case I had with a company, and I saved them, and the insurance company saved them $1.1 million.
Wow.
Guy had a big claim in for, said he had gas inhalation, but I went and investigated, and I discovered that he couldn't have happened. What he's saying happened couldn't have happened. In actual fact, I had a professor from Trinity with me doing these, and he said, "Look, Pat, if those two chemicals met, and he was there, he'd be dead. It's not a case." He said, "So it could not have happened." And he said it was a fluorescent sort of buzz of stuff. He says, they don't mix like that. Mm. There would be just be a smell and he'd be dead. That's it. So it couldn't have happened. So we were able to, and that and other things, like I had him working and stuff, and he said he couldn't work, and then he said he couldn't drive. The smell of diesel affected him and all this, that and the other. And so we had him spinning around the place and not bothering him, like, you know. Mm. So I had some very interesting ones.
We would be so happy to sit and chat with you again. Yeah, it's been intriguing.
You get me on the buzz, I could keep going. I've loads of stories and loads of things.
And your books, you know. I'm sure.
And what is the title of the book, Pat, to let us know?
Of the book is Murder at Lordship.
Murder at Lordship.
Murder at Lordship, Inside the Hunt for a Detective's Killer.
Excellent.
Wow.
And it's launch. It's out on. It's we are have a launch on the 1st of May in the Odeon in Harcourt Street, and on the 3rd of May in Mullingar and Easons.
The third of May.
Yeah,
and you're more than welcome. You know,
we might turn up there.
7 o'clock. A few nibblies, maybe a glass of wine, and that's it. And it'll Paul Williams is going to.
Brilliant.
Do a little talk, and myself and Robin Schiller. You know Robin wrote the book. The two of us wrote the book.
Wow.
You know. And it's fascinating. Like, it was the biggest murder investigation ever in the state.
Wow.
And the longest murder trial ever. It was on for over 6 months. I think we had 173 witnesses or something. It was colossal. It was mind-boggling. I often think back and I say, geez, how did I manage that? Like, but I did manage it, and I kept solid. And a great team of people, like, you know, and that's it. But
so anybody who's into their crime murder or mystery, buy that book.
Oh, it's because there's a lot in that book that people don't know about.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they'll be surprised, say, oh, this is what was done. And, you know.
And how it's done.
Yeah, you know.
So. Pat, thank you so much.
No, you're more than welcome.
Bye from me.
And goodbye from me.